Good morning. This is Jeff Blankford back in the KZYX studios welcoming you to the December 24th Christmas Eve edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month, and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to you, our listeners. That my last program came on Thanksgiving Eve, that today's is on Christmas Eve, and that I'll be back with you again next Wednesday on New Year's Eve when I open the phones for your Takes on the World, is, of course, a coincidence, and despite my wishing you all the best of the holiday season in the coming year, today's program will offer little in the way of holiday cheer. Well, that's not entirely true. When I speak to today's guest, former CIA official Phil Giraldi, about prospects for U.S. foreign policy in the coming year, that's 20 minutes past the hour, there will be at least one bright spot. It is, as you may guess, President Obama's announcement that after 55 years of trying ineffectually to overthrow the government of Cuba, the White House will renew diplomatic relations with Havana. Given that Obama's penchant for regime change in other areas of the world has been consistent with that of his predecessors, there is no guarantee, however, that throwing open the doors of the U.S. Embassy in Havana, if they have not rusted in place, and reestablishing friendly relations between the two countries does not represent a change in tactics more than a change in policy. The current spat between North Korea and Sony Pictures, represented in the court of public opinion by President Obama, over the release of a Hollywood comedy that features a CIA-ordered assassination of Kim Jong-un by two nutty American journalists, should be seen as evidence of that, considering that the film was vetted by the State Department before its announced release. Most of the reporting on the story is focused on the president's criticism of Sony's decision, since reversed. It'll be shown at 200 picture theaters tomorrow. I'm not to release the film entitled The Interview, following warnings attributed to the North Korean government of what would happen to theaters that showed it. In his year-end White House news conference last week, President Obama coupled North Korea's alleged threats with the equally unproven accusations that it had previously shut down Sony's websites and initially spoke as if North Korea had committed an act of war. Revealed as part of that hacking, which he didn't mention, was an email exchange between two Sony Pictures executives on what kind of films President Obama prefers to watch that was overtly racist and which the two later apologized. Bloomberg News pointed out that, quote, Obama promised to retaliate against North Korea for the Sony hack, answering a largely unresolved legal and political question surrounding cyber warfare. The U.S. government will act on behalf of a private company after an attack. They caused a lot of damage, said Obama, and we will respond. We will respond proportionally and will respond in place and time and manner that we choose. 2 days later, he acknowledged in a CNN interview that the hack was a costly act of cyber vandalism rather than an act of war. On Monday, it was reported that all of North Korea's access to the Internet had been shut down, suggesting that this might have been Washington's response. What was apparently missing from every discussion of the subject, and why I bring it up here, in the mainstream media, was any reference to the long and sordid history of U.S. involvement in the assassinations of foreign heads of state, whose policies and activities did not meet with Washington's approval, a category in which all of North Korea's leaders, including Kim Jong-un, would conveniently fit. Also, the question has not been raised as to what would be the American reaction to learn that Iran or Russia, or for that matter North Korea, was releasing a film depicting the assassination of an American president. I doubt very much that the claims for the right of free expression that we have heard in defense of The Interview would get much of a hearing here. What the dispute over the non-showing of The Interview managed to do, however, was to move more important stories from the front pages of the national media and the Sunday talk shows. One was the follow-up to the release of the Senate report on the use of torture by the CIA since 9/11. It should have created a significant problem for President Obama, since the current head of the CIA, the man he appointed to the job, John Brennan, has defended the agency's actions and criticized the Senate Intelligence Committee, headed by California's Dianne Feinstein, over its conclusions. Let me be clear, said Brennan in a hastily called press conference 2 days after the release of the Senate's 528-page report. We have not concluded that it was the EITs, enhanced interrogation techniques, within that program that allowed us to obtain useful information from the detainees subjected to them. It's unknowable. But Brennan staunchly defended the agency during the 45-minute news conference, adding, quote, CIA officers' actions that did comport with the law and policy should neither be criticized nor conflated with the actions of the few who did not follow the guidance issued. End quote. Brennan never used the word torture to describe the CIA's tactics, nor did he directly reply when asked, in the interest of transparency, if he supported the Senate Intelligence Committee's decision to release the report. Well, I think there have been more than enough transparency that's happened over the last couple of days, he said. I think it's over the top, end quote. Brennan was clearly not on the same page as his boss. One of the things that sets us apart from other countries is that when we make mistakes, we admit them, Obama told the Spanish language television network Telemundo. I hope that today's report can help us leave these techniques where they belong, in the past, he said in a statement. The president made it clear that his Justice Department, however, was not considering prosecuting the torturers or those in the Bush White House who legitimized their behavior. This was consistent with his opposition, despite being elected on an anti-war platform, to setting up a government inquiry to determine who should be held responsible for launching the Iraq War. Even the New York Times, which had beaten the drums for that war, felt obliged to point this out in an editorial on December 10th. It said, quote, "The litany of brutality, lawlessness, and lack of accountability serves as a reminder of what a horrible decision President Obama made at the outset of his administration to close the books on this chapter in our history, even as he repudiated the use of torture. The CIA officials who destroyed videotapes and waterboarding were left unpunished, and all attempts at bringing these acts into a courtroom were blocked by claims of national secrets," end quote. In this, I should note, he was supported by the entire Democratic Party leadership, most loudly by House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. On the very same day that Obama was giving the torturers and his CIA chief a free pass, the White House was announcing sanctions against a number of Venezuelan officials for their alleged roles in suppressing anti-government protests in Caracas. That hypocrisy, too, has been a hallmark of Obama's presidency. Another important story has been misreported even before it, too, was eclipsed as the economic war that the United States began waging on Russia that erupted to the surface with February's coup against the unpopular but legally elected government of Ukraine immediately after President Yanukovych, at that president, had agreed to hold new presidential elections. That's just one of the cogent facts that has been eliminated from Washington's official narrative of the Ukraine-Russia conflict, and the mainstream media has followed suit. Equally important are the roles played by the U.S. Ambassador Jeff Pyatt, and more significantly, Obama's Deputy Secretary of State for Europe, Victoria Nuland Kagan, whose husband Robert Kagan was the founder of the Project for a New American Century, and its successor, the Foreign Policy Initiative. In one of my programs prior to the coup, I played part of a speech of Nuland Kagan to Ukrainian-American businessmen, in which she revealed that the U.S. had already invested $5 billion in its efforts to overthrow the Ukrainian government. In another program, I played part of a secretly recorded clip of a phone conversation between Nuland Kagan and Ambassador Pyatt, in which she used a common four-letter expletive to describe the European Union and named with uncanny accuracy her choice as to who should run Ukraine after the coup. His name was Arseniy Yatsenyuk, who, with an obvious familiarity, she referred to as Yahtzee. He since has become Ukraine's prime minister. How about that? While the coup was wildly popular in the more European-oriented Western Ukraine, where it took place, it was clearly equally unpopular in the Eastern Ukraine and in Crimea, which had long been part of Russia, and while still part of the Soviet Union, had been given to Ukraine in 1956 by Nikita Khrushchev himself, Ukrainian-born. That meant little at the time, but even after the breakup of the USSR and the independence of Ukraine, Russia's interest in Crimea was recognized. At the time of the coup, it maintained an important naval base in the Black Sea, manned by more than 20,000 Russian troops. In other words, when the Ukrainians voted overwhelmingly to be united with Russia, when East Ukrainians in Crimea, Russian troops were already on Crimea's soil. The annexation of Crimea plus Russian support for the independence movement in predominantly Russian-speaking sectors of eastern Ukraine led to the imposition of sanctions against the government of Vladimir Putin at the behest of Washington that were to a considerable extent and remain unpopular with a number of the European governments whose business communities had significant dealings with the Russians and have suffered accordingly. At the moment, while a shaky ceasefire between Ukraine's army and Russian-backed separatists in eastern Ukraine seems to be holding, the economies of both countries are in deep trouble. Already damaged by the sanctions, the collapse of the price of oil from above $100 a barrel down to $70, and most recently to $250 to $55 a barrel, has been devastating to the Russian economy and to its currency, the ruble, which has dropped in value by 30% against the dollar. Last week, the New York Times reported that, quote, with Russia already staggering under the weight of one of its worst financial crises in years, the United States signaled that it would further increase the economic pressure with a new raft of sanctions targeting the Russian defense, energy, and banking industries. President Obama said, through a spokesman, that he would sign newly passed legislation expanding measures intended to cordon off large Russian state firms from Western financing and technology, while also providing $350 million in arms and military equipment to Ukraine as it battles a pro-Russian insurgency in its eastern regions. Well, that Ukraine is even worse economic shape needs money more than it needs weapons. Its currency, the hryvnia, has fallen even more than the ruble. The economy is already contracted by 7%, and remaining international reserves are sufficient, it's reported, to cover only about 6 weeks of imports. Preventing an implosion will require $15 billion in fresh assistance in 2015, according to the European Union. That's on top of the $17 billion IMF bailout arrangement. In an interview with Germany's Der Spiegel on Monday, Yatsenyuk, Newland Kagan's favorite, justified his country's recently passed neoliberal reforms, referring to them as essential for Ukraine's incorporation into the European Union. They include cost increases in public services, the elimination of free medical care, the firing of a number of public officials, and the sale of some state enterprises. In other words, as Ukraine Minister of Economic Development, Ivan Abramovich, told Der Spiegel, Ukraine is, quote, bankrupt. Meanwhile, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict has entered yet another chapter, which we are told that the future of the two peoples is up for grabs. In the midst of a government deadlock over a new law declaring Israel to be a Jewish state that would eliminate Arabic as one of the country's official languages and make Israeli Palestinians, who make up 20% of the country's population, more of a second-class minority than they already are, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu dissolved the Knesset and called for new national elections this March. This will see him either return for yet another term as prime minister or be replaced by a center coalition which we pledged on paper at least to push for a two-state solution, something that has been reinforced and re-endorsed by a number of Western European countries who have recognized the state of Palestine. This will see either Netanyahu return for yet another term as prime minister or be replaced by a center coalition which would be pledged on paper at least to push for a two-state solution. Meanwhile, in one of his ritualized threats that come to nothing, the Palestinian Authority's unelected and unpopular President Mahmoud Abbas threatened to break off ties with Israel yet again if a Palestinian drafted United Nations Security Council resolution demanding Israeli withdrawal from the West Bank by 2017 fails to pass. Speaking to reporters in Algeria, Abbas said the Palestinians are, quote, determined to restore their rights, including the right of return for refugees and the release of all Palestinians from Israeli prisons, the Algerian press service reported. Abbas went on, if we fail, we will halt all dealings with the Israeli government and ask it to assume its responsibilities as an occupation state. What he means by dealings is close cooperation with Israeli security services to restrict Palestinian resistance to Israel's continuing theft of Palestinian land and destruction of their farms, not to mention the killing of Palestinians on a weekly basis. The U.S., which holds veto power in the U.N. Security Council, has indicated it will veto any Palestine Authority resolution that supports unilateral actions outside of negotiations between Israelis and Palestinians. I'll finish this segment with a report on the latest U.S. undeclared war, the one against what in the Middle East is called Daesh, and in the West, for obvious reasons, the Islamic State, ISIS or ISIL. I say obvious because the U.S. and Israel, and those who accept their dictates, prefer to demonize Islam whenever an opportunity presents itself, and Islamic State sounds a lot more threatening than does Daesh. Apart from that, as costs for that war initiated this summer have now exceeded the $1 billion mark. The U.S.-led fight is getting its own inspector general to oversee government spending. John Reimer, the Pentagon's inspector general, will serve as the lead inspector general for Operation Inherent Resolve. That's what they're calling it. His office announced Monday. As of December 11, 2014, the total cost since kinetic operations started on August 8, 2014, is $1.02 billion, and the average daily cost is $8.1 million, Pentagon spokesman Bill Urban said on Monday. The total cost, however, excludes other U.S. activities the Obama administration began in June to kick off the campaign to degrade and destroy Daesh. It is a commitment that the Secretary of State John Kerry says will be measured, most likely, in years.